The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Live from our nation's capital, it's Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.
Welcome to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. I'm Brad Bannon. I'm a national democratic strategist, a columnist for The Hill in Washington, D.C., and a political analyst for news radio stations KNX in Los Angeles and WGN in Chicago. My company, Bannon Communications Research, polls for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democrats. If you'd like to know more about me and my political polling company, or you have any ideas for Deadline DC, the best way to reach me is on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Brad Bannon. Today, we will talk about the first 100 days of Joe Biden's presidential administration. Our guests to discuss the Biden presidency are Charlie Cook, founder and publisher of the Cook Political Report, and Kimberly Taylor Scott, who is the publisher of Demlist. First, though, we're going to listen to the president talk about his goal of reaching COVID vaccinations in the first 100 days of his presidency.
Back in December, I set a goal of administering 100 million shots, vaccine shots, in my first 100 days in office. At the time, some told us that couldn't be done. It was awfully ambitious, but we did it in 58 days because of the incredible staff I have. And so I set a second goal, to deliver 200 million shots in my first 100 days in office. The goal unmatched in the world or in prior mass vaccination efforts in American history. When tomorrow's vaccine and vaccination numbers come out, we will show that today we did it. Today we hit 200 million shots and the 92nd day in office. 200 million shots in 100 days, in under 100 days, actually. It's an incredible achievement for the nation.
Our guest in this half hour is Charlie Cook, the founder and publisher of the Cook Political Report. Charlie is one of America's most prominent and shrewdest political observers. He also writes a column for the National Journal. Welcome back to Deadline DC, Charlie. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Brad.
Okay, let's start with this. This is a big week for Joe Biden. On Wednesday, he gives a address to a joint session of Congress. He also, on Thursday, will mark the 100th day of his presidency. Tell us, in general, what you think about Joe Biden, the first 100 days of Joe Biden's presidency.
I think we all have to say that we're a bit surprised. I mean, a lot of my progressive friends a year ago were not that excited. They thought that, you know, they were hoping for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or someone like that, and that he would be kind of boring and kind of a centrist and very incremental. And he has been anything but that. I mean, who would have thought Joe Biden, you know, whether you agree or disagree with what he's doing, he's bold. It looks more like FDR's New Deal or Lyndon Johnson's Great Society than it looks like sort of, you know, a boring older white guy becoming president. Overall, though, in terms of his numbers, you know, they're certainly, you know, a whole lot better. I mean, obviously better than Donald Trump's, but that's obviously a low bar. You know, he's averaging 53-54% approval ratings in the Real Clear Politics and 538. But when you break it out by issue, off the charts, spectacularly well on coronavirus. And on economy mixed between sort of a net single digits to net, I think the best I've seen is 10 or 11 approve over disapprove on the economy. And then immigration or immigration border security is just horrific. And so that's sort of how it's sizing up with public opinion. But it has been a very, very different presidency than I think we all expected. And, it's things like this is what keep you humble in this business.
Yeah, that's for sure. I've been humbled a number of times in the many years I've been in this business, that's for sure. Well, let's explore your thought about the novelty of Biden's presidency. I think everyone, just about everyone, thought he would be, he certainly ran as a moderate, he ran as a centrist, especially in the Democratic primary, but he turned out to be a very activist president. He's called himself, or at least he said he wanted to be a transformational president. Why do you think things turned out this way? Why did he belie everybody's expectations of what his presidency would be like?
I've been thinking a lot about this, of what the difference between what we've seen and what we thought. And here are a couple of different theories. One is sort of the new paradigm. There's a feeling in the Democratic Party that the coronavirus and the economic fallout from the coronavirus has just changed everything. And that people, not only people's tolerance for, but their expectation of government doing more may be substantially larger than it was or than we anticipated. And the polling is kind of mixed. Some show little change from before when you ask do you think government should do more to solve our problems, or that government's doing too many things best left to business individual? It has changed with a more activist, but whether it's a somewhat change or a larger change is a bit up in the air. A second theory is, the Democratic Party has changed, that this party is not only a whole lot more progressive than it was under Bill Clinton, but it's a good bit more progressive than it was under Barack Obama. I think a third thing, though, is that I think that there are some ghosts from President Obama's first term that are sort of hanging over this administration. There's a feeling that, number one, that the stimulus package that President Obama pushed through in 2009, that it was really too little. It wasn't nearly as big, as aggressive as it should have, and that they made compromises in order to try to get Republican support. That in the end, they got 3 Republican senators and 0 Republican House members, but they watered it down. And as a result, the recovery coming out of that was just a lot weaker than expected. And there's also just sort of a lot of scar tissue of people that a lot of the people around President Biden were in the White House under Obama. And the feeling among a lot of those folks is it was a waste of time to try to negotiate with Republicans. They were never going to negotiate in good faith, and they just wasted a whole lot of time. And then the final theory is, and you notice in the news conference that the president's news conference two weeks ago, where he talked about he believed in fate. He was a big believer in fate, and that he knows he's 78 years old and turned 82 3 weeks after the election. He knows that, 30 odd years ago, he had a couple of brain aneurysms. He knows, lost his first wife and a daughter to a car wreck back in 1972, lost his son, Bo, at 46. That maybe in life, you've got to do what you can when you can and don't hold back. And then the final is the Georgia theory, that he was going to be incremental. He was going to do the sort of centrist route. But when Democrats won both those Georgia Senate race seats on January 5th and took a majority, they basically, like in football, they called an audible. They just changed the play right there on the line of scrimmage and went with a different approach than they might have expected them to do, and that they probably expected to do. So it's probably some combination of several of those.
Okay. Today on Deadline DC, we'll be discussing the first 100 days of Joe Biden's presidency. It's going to be a big week for him. Our guest in this segment is Charlie Cook, the founder and publisher of the Cook Political Report, which in my mind is the preeminent political publication in the United States. If you want to keep up with the trends in American politics, there's certainly no better way to do that than to read the Cook Political Report. We're going to be back with Charlie after this very quick break to discuss more about Joe Biden and also the Republican response to the first 100 days of the Biden administration. So please don't go anywhere. There's a lot more left in the show with Charlie Cook. And in the second half hour, our guest will be Kimberly Scott, who's the publisher of Demlist. So hang in there. We'll be right back after this short message. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest is Charlie Cook, publisher of the Cook Political Report, which is the foremost newsletter and website examining the ins and outs of American politics. And we're glad Charlie could take the time to be on the show today. Charlie, you were talking about presidential job ratings when I so rudely interrupted you.
It used to be that there were honeymoons. So that, you know, you had with President Kennedy had an approval rating among Republicans at this point of 63% and Eisenhower among Democrats of 64. Wow. And then we went through a period that was of elected presidents, Nixon, Carter, Reagan, George H.W. Bush, where at this point, you know, they'd have a job approval ratings in the mid 40s among the opposition party. And then we went into the Clinton, George W. Bush, Donald Trump era, Clinton and George W., where it'd be in the 20s, late 30s, and now Trump was 9 points, and Biden is 11 points, where there's practically nobody in either side willing to sort of give the other side any benefit of the doubt whatsoever, and the parties have just become so ideologically sorted that there's no crossover whatsoever.
So is there anything Joe Biden can do about that, or is anything anybody can do about it?
I think it's play for independence, that we're in a time when Republicans are never going to, they would, if he said the sun was going to rise in the east, they would look west. And I mean, that just is what it is. And that Democrats are going to be loyal to him and is playing for independence. And, you know, they better hope that the program they've got, that it paces to create all the jobs and the stimulus and do all the good works it's intended to do, but not overheat the economy. Because the problem is the economy right now, it is picking up, and it does look like it's going in a better direction than it looked 6 months ago. So, you know, this is kind of like Goldilocks. I mean, they got to make sure it's warm, it's hot enough, but not too hot. And, you know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But Democrats have, you know, as you know, they have very little margins in terms of the House and Senate. So not much can go wrong.
Yeah, not much can. Well, let me ask you about the Republicans. They have been the opposition party now for almost 100 days. How have the Republicans handled their opposition to Joe Biden in the first 100 days of his presidency?
Well, I mean, I think you're talking about two groups of people that are, you know, they're in the evening, they're not watching. They sure as hell aren't watching CNN or MSNBC. And to be honest, they're not watching ABC or CBS or NBC. I mean, if they're not watching Fox, it's going to be Newsmax or One Nation or whatever the hell that thing is, where in their world, you know, from what they're seeing, there is nothing Joe Biden is doing that's right. And so they, we just live in different media universes. I think some of the bloom is off the Trump rose with the Republican base, but not all of it at all. And one of the questions that's good to look at in the NBC, new NBC News poll is they ask people, Republicans, do you consider yourself more a supporter of Donald Trump or a supporter of the Republican Party? And those numbers were dead even going into the election. And now it's about a 12-point gap between loyal to the Republican Party and loyalty to Donald Trump. And so he still has a lot of sway, but on the edge, I mean, it's starting to settle down a little bit. But, you know, the Republican Party is not going back to where it was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. That's not going to happen.
Today in an interview, Representative Liz Cheney said that Donald Trump wasn't the leader of the Republican Party. The leaders of the Republican Party were Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, and Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader. Is he whistling past the graveyard? It seems to me that Trump can still make the Republican Party jump at will.
Well, if you see him getting into primaries next year, you're going to see, and I'll use this term, you will see, you may well see some pretty exotic Republican nominees emerge in some of these races, which would be a gift to from the heavens for Democrats. I mean, you remember in Delaware and Missouri and Indiana, where Republicans, they just booted seats that they otherwise would have won. Does that happen? Yes or no? And so it's, you know, part of President Biden's fate, part of it's in his own hands, part's in the hands of the economy, and part is, do Republicans go off on this wild, you know, tear and nominate a bunch of nuts?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, let me ask you this question. Is the Republican Party doing enough to build itself back up? It seems to me they've been very defensive. Rather than expanding the Republican Party, they've been trying to be a very, very defensive with new laws that restrict voting. Are they doing enough to build themselves back up into the prominent political force in this country or not?
You know, there's certainly some substantial elements within the Republican Party that if they could go back to black and white television, just get rid of color TV, they probably would, because things obviously were better back in the 50s in that mindset. You're right, they are. I mean, what they're doing is they're alienating not only minority voters, but also younger voters. And I guarantee you, no decent political consultant is advising them to do this. This is organic. This is them. And I think it's a horrible mistake. But they, you know, I think Mitch McConnell put up with Donald Trump for a long time. And I think after Georgia, he holds Trump personally responsible for Republicans losing those two Georgia seats and control of the Senate. And for Mitch McConnell, that is an unforgivable thing. And so he is trying to kind of wrestle the party away from President Trump. Kevin McCarthy's trying to have it both ways. But the thing is, President Trump has his fundraising lists. I mean, that's what McCarthy and House Republicans want. That's what they're dependent upon. They know he could raise $1 zillion for a potted plant by midnight. And they either have access.
I think he has already.
Or they don't. And, you know, that's why, there's a real division between Republicans who want their party to adapt to the future and those that just don't want that to happen. And it, it's, You know, I believe in the two-party system. And when either side is trying their best to self-destruct, I don't think it's good for the system.
No, it isn't. It's certainly not good for anybody. Charlie, thank you for joining us on Deadline DC today. We'll be back with more of Deadline DC after these messages. And again, thank you to Charlie Cook, publisher of the Cook Political Report. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. We're going to start the second half hour with a clip from President Biden talking about the diversity in his cabinet.
Today, I'm pleased to announce that such a nominee we have, Dr. Miguel Cardona. Like other cabinet nominees and appointees, he's brilliant, he's qualified, and he's tested. And he's going to join the Biden-Harris cabinet, and it's going to be a historic cabinet. Already, there are more people of color in this cabinet than any cabinet in the history of the United States. There are more women than ever. First openly gay cabinet member. It's a cabinet that looks like America. It taps into the best of America. That opens doors and includes the full range of talents we have in this nation.
Okay, that was, of course, President Biden. This half hour of Deadline DC is brought to you by my company, Bannon Communication Research, which polls for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democrats. One of the most noteworthy events of Joe Biden's first 100 days came at the start of his presidency, his appointments. The Biden administration is full of firsts, and it's very diverse. Biden's first choice for an administration position was the selection of Senator Kamala Harris to be his running mate. She became the first vice president on Inauguration Day. She is also the first woman to serve as second in command and the first person of African American and Asian ancestry to serve in the position. There were two other noteworthy firsts on the top shelf of the Biden cabinet. Janet Yellen became the first woman to first serve as Secretary of Treasury, and Lloyd Austin is the first African American to preside over the Pentagon. Treasury and defense, along with justice and state, are first among equals in any presidential administration. And these groundbreaking appointments were a clear statement of President Biden's commitment to groups who are a big part of the nation and which played a pivotal role in his election. The Census Bureau and the Department of Commerce has estimated that most Americans will be people of color by 2044. Which is less than a generation away. Demography is destiny, and Biden's choices clearly proclaim that America's destiny is diversity. You can read the rest of my column and all my columns in The Hill at muckrack.com/Brad-Bannon. Our guest today in the second half hour is Kimberly Scott. Kim is publisher of Demlist and the editor of Dem Daily, a political column dedicated to educating and informing the public about the Democratic Party, policy, and politics. Sign up for the column is at www.demlist.com. The Twitter handle is the Demlist, and I strongly advise you to sign up for Demlist. I read it every day, and it's a great way of keeping informed about the Democratic Party, its vision, its policies, and its future. Kim, welcome to Deadline DC. How are you doing today?
Great. It's a beautiful day on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C.
I'm glad of that. Okay, let's start with this. This is a big week for Joe Biden. On Wednesday, he's giving an address to a joint session of Congress. And on Thursday marks the 100th day of his presidency. I should also say that when he addresses Congress on Wednesday night, it will be the first time there will be two women sitting behind the president as he addresses a joint session of Congress. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and Vice President Kamala Harris, which is an historic first. Let's talk about the diversity in the Biden administration. It seems to me Joe Biden's gone a long way into making this a different cabinet, the proverbial cabinet. And this cabinet really does look like America. Women, African Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans. What has the diversity in Joe Biden's cabinet done for America?
Well, for one, it gives them faith in the president and his administration. He and Kamala Harris promised that they would appoint a cabinet that is reflective of the country and the diversity of the country, and they have. It's 55% non-white, it's 45% women. As you pointed out, you know, the representation is exactly what he promised. You know, you've got Deb Haaland, who is the first female American Indian. You've got Javier Becerra, Martha Fudge, Pete Buttigieg, who's openly gay. Biden has gone to great lengths to deliver on his promise. And none is more evident than the fact he said we, on Wednesday night, standing behind him before he even says a word, we get into the accomplishments of the 100 days. He has behind him the first female vice president and Nancy Pelosi, the speaker.
And the first female speaker and the only female speaker so far.
And her third time.
Well, that raises an interesting question, Kim. This is a nation that is deeply divided. It's deeply divided by race. It's deeply divided by color. It's probably deeply divided by a whole bunch of stuff. What can Joe Biden do as president to bring this nation together? He's done a lot for this country already. The economy's starting to pick up. The pandemic is beginning to recede. But his biggest challenge, it seems to me, is bringing some calm and normalcy to this country. What can Joe Biden do as president to heal a divided nation?
Well, I think he is on the road there. You know, he has made some significant accomplishments in those first 100 days. Naturally, the first subject, the top of the list, as is evident by polling, I think 69% approval rating for how he's delivering on the coronavirus. That is most immediate and affects people of all ages and backgrounds. That the assurance that he has given in the aftermath, or I should say in the ongoing crisis of the coronavirus, has been given through legislation. He has been able to deliver up to $1,400 stimulus checks to individuals, making it both stress and the economic burden lightened. There are more who are today under less of an economic burden than there have been when Biden took office. He has 1 million jobs are back. And he also has done things that help restore faith to our international reputation, like re-signing the Paris Climate Accord. Now, all that being said, at the same time, there is still a wave of, I think, anxiety, anticipation across the country that is fueled in the wake of 4 years of Donald Trump and the racial divide that has become even greater as a result of those 4 years. And it's being tested regularly. You know, last night I was watching the Oscars, and which is usually a forum for for Hollywood to express their political opinions, where, of course, in the last 4 years, it's been Trump.
Yeah, we're going to go to break now, but when we come back, we can continue discussing the Oscars, because I think it was a meaningful political event last night. We're going to break now, but when we come back, we'll have more of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest in this half hour is Kimberly Scott, who is the founder and publisher of Demlist. So you'll be sure to want to come back, because we still have a lot of great show for you in the second half hour. Okay, welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest in this half hour is Kimberly Scott, who is the founder and publisher of Demlist, which is a great way to be in, keep informed about Democratic Party politics and policy. And the personalities in the Democratic Party. And there are a lot of personalities in the Democratic Party. If you're one of our radio listeners and you'd like to watch the show, please go to www.periscope.tv /Brad Bannon. And so you can watch us as well as listen to us. Anyway, we were talking before the break, we were talking about the Oscars. Kim, the big winner, I should point out, the big winner last night was a movie I know we've both seen, Nomadland. The director was the first woman of color to win an Oscar for Best Director. The movie Nomadland won Best Picture. Frances McDormand, who is the lead actress, won the Best Actress Oscar. So it was a big night. But it seemed, you know, it seemed to me, first of all, it was a great picture. I think it was very well made. It was very bleak, which I think reflects the times we live in, sadly. But it's also about, you know, a woman who's displaced by bad economy. She loses her husband. She loses the town she lives in. She loses her own home, and she goes on the road. But it seemed to me it was, you know, a very strong political statement about the people, you know, at the lower end of the economic scale who have been displaced by the economy in the last decade.
Absolutely. And that is, it's not unlike the messages that came out of those that were the top nominees. There were a slate of films that were more profound, that appealed to our personal experiences and personal hope as well. There were not big blockbusters in there. It was a different kind of year. But again, you know, throughout the, and that, those kind of sentiments were reflected throughout the whole evening. It wasn't so much this that there were, no one was the brunt of jokes. There were not, you know, political statements about individuals. It was about events. It was about happenings. It's about what we've been through. And quite honestly, as always, how movies are able to help connect us, particularly when we're apart.
Okay. Let's try something else. I want to talk about a couple events from last week. Of course, probably the big news story last week was the conviction of former police officer Derek Chauvin in the murder of George Floyd. It seems to me, well, first of all, do you think that the conviction of Chauvin will lead to a change in police violence against African Americans. Pretty much every week you read a story about a young African American who is killed by a police officer. It's become an epidemic. Do you think the Chauvin trial will lead to a change in the relationship between African Americans and their local police departments?
I certainly hope so. This, watching the Chauvin trial, and I tried not to watch it in great length, but I know that, people all across the country, all across the world, were glued into that trial to see an outcome. And much as there have been, other significant events in our history, we'll always remember. We'll remember the day that verdict came down. Was the nation on a precipice waiting for that? And again, waiting for what message that kinds of send, that verdict would send. And I know in the House and the Senate, the House has passed legislation on police reform, and they're working on a compromise now in the Senate between Senator Tim Scott, the only African-American Republican senator, and Cory Booker from New Jersey are working with Karen Bass, who was the sponsor of the House legislation, to try to come to some kind of compromise on police reforms. But even at the speed of which it went through and the focus on it now nationally, I think guarantees that there will be some level of reform. Will it appease everybody? We'll have to see.
Yeah, nothing pleases everybody in this day and age, unfortunately. Today, there's news on that front. This morning, the new Attorney General, Merrick Garland, announced that the Justice Department would be investigating the behavior of the Louisville, Kentucky Police Department in the death of Breonna Taylor, who was killed in a police raid on her residence last year. I guess I should also say on Friday, Attorney General Garland also announced there would be a DOG investigation into a previous incident of Officer Chauvin mistreating a young black offender. So it seems to me the Biden administration is on top of this thing. What do you think the Biden administration can do to heal the racial divides in this country, or can it do anything? It just seems that, I always hoped I had this sort of misplaced confidence when Barack Obama was elected not only once, but twice as president. We were on our way to a new golden era of race relations. That didn't work out very well, partly, I think, because Donald Trump rolled back a lot of the progress that Barack Obama had made. But what can Joe Biden do to heal the racial wounds in this country? Or is there anything he can do to do it?
I absolutely believe he can. And it started again with a diverse cabinet and delivering on his promise. I think the most effective thing that he's done with all of this so far is transparency. So, and most issues, he's very out front about where the administration stands, the efforts that they're trying to make. He is clearly, in this case, trying to keep a balance, and where he is not stepping in like Trump did before with his Justice Department or ruling from the top down. It is as police reform legislation is a good step in the right direction. But I think it is a matter of being totally transparent with the American public. And hearing them. But it's,
now, one
it's
of
what
the things
for him to lead.
Yeah, and I hope he can do it. It's it'd be interesting to see, because I think this is, you got a bad economy, you got a deadly pandemic, but it seems to me healing the racial wounds in this country is right at the top of the list. Let me ask you briefly, this is probably my last question, Kim. Walter Mondale, the former vice president to Bill Clinton and the Democratic presidential nominee in 1984, died last week. What can you say about Walter Mondale and his contribution to American politics?
Well, I did a column in memoriam to him, which can be found on dimlist.com. But he was a statesman, and the kind which we can hope to see again in our future. You know, his service through the Senate as vice president, as ambassador, very few, as Biden said, individuals, political figures have ever been so respected. And I think one of his last actions before passing says the most about him, and that was that he sent an email to roughly 350 of his former staffers spanning 4 decades, saying goodbye to them and thanking them for being a part of his journey.
Yeah, it was a act of class, like the man himself. Kim, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Deadline DC with Brad Bannon today. I want to thank both our guests, Charlie Cook, who is the publisher of the Cook Political Report, and of course, Kimberly Taylor, the publisher of Demlist. That's it for Deadline DC today. Make sure you listen to Leslie Marshall. She'll be back tomorrow. Be safe and be strong in these troubled times. And make sure you turn into Deadline DC every Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on periscope.tv/Brad Bannon.